Good morning, or I should, say good afternoon. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, or at least the virtual space of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Perhaps I should say welcome to your own homes. But as the parties are aware, and for the record, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is declining to hold oral arguments live at the Minnesota Judicial Center here in St. Paul, or in the other courtrooms where we typically hold oral arguments outstate. And we're doing so for the good of the public, for the good of the parties, the attorneys, and court staff, in light of the ongoing national pandemic and state of emergency. And we're therefore entertaining these arguments by a video conferencing tool, WebEx, with none of the parties or judges present in the same room. And just so the parties are aware, in case you haven't had one of these WebEx arguments, the technology is not a perfect substitute for imperfect hearings, but we'll try to recognize if we have any glitches. You can certainly alert us or wave your hand if there's any difficulty hearing or seeing us, and we can pause so the technology can keep up with us. But in keeping with due process, our hearings do remain open to the public, even though no one from the public is on the actual presentation now. The audio recording of the proceedings will be made available to them, and so anyone who would like to can hear the argument but not see the argument. And with that, I'll just call our first case, which is in the matter of Walmart versus Anoka County. Parties, each of you will have 15 minutes, of course, to present your argument, with 15 minutes to the relator, 15 minutes to the respondent, and then additional 5 minutes to the relator if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. And do state your name for the record, for the audio recording of things, as you begin each leg of your argument. And with that, counsel for relator, you have the floor.
Thank you, Judge Ross, and may it please the court. My name is Mark Bradford with Bassford Remley. I represent the relator, Walmart, in this appeal. We are requesting that the court reverse the ALJ's legal determination that the county's CLE presentation is work product and immune from disclosure under the Data Practices Act. I want to just say this at the outset. The general notion that a CLE presentation in a PowerPoint that is admittedly prepared for purposes of conducting a seminar for which continuing legal education credit was sought and obtained can somehow constitute privileged attorney work product is unknown to the law and unsupported by any decision that has been cited to this court from Minnesota or anywhere else. The court should reverse for four reasons. Number one, there is no dispute in this case that the CLE materials at issue are government data under Section 13.02 and therefore are presumed public. Number two, the work product immunity, as this court defined the scope of that protection in the published City Pages decision, does not apply to the CLE presentation because, as the county admits, and as the County Attorneys Association also acknowledges, those materials were not prepared in anticipation of litigation, and there is no such finding in the ALJ's decision. Number three, at a broader level, the concept of work product immunity is simply and directly incongruent with the county seeking and obtaining CLE credit for the presentation. Work product is something the lawyer gets paid to create. A CLE presentation is not. And number four, even if the materials are work product, there is no common interest exception to waiver that could possibly apply in this situation, where Anoka County indiscriminately disseminated the PowerPoint presentation through a webinar to over 80 different participants in other counties whose cases, which were existing or even potential, Anoka County has no interest in. I'm going to spend most of my time today discussing the work product doctrine, but before I do that, I want to return to point one, which is government data are presumed public. And that's important here because the ALJ concluded that these are government data. And therefore, we're really only talking about whether an exception to disclosure applies in Section 13.363. And those exceptions, as the Minnesota Supreme Court held in Prior Lake, are construed narrowly. So we're really talking about a narrow work product exception which this case rises and falls on.
Mr. Bradford, can I take you, can I take you off track for a bit?
Sure.
Going to the common interest exception issue, I'm wondering whether there's a matter that's not really been briefed, at least it comes to my mind, that may be of some concern to the court, and that is in the context of the CLE. As I understand it, your brief does indicate, the county's does also, that the program receives CLE credit, which means, if I understand the Board of Continuing Legal Education rule correctly, that means an entity, in this case the county, submitted material for approval by a board. And the board, of course, is not comprised of county attorneys. It's comprised of a number of individuals, some appointed by the court, some on the board elsewise. But I'm wondering whether it matters to our analysis that this material is presented to an outside board for review, both as it regards the approval, but then any review of the material and substance to make sure it complies with the requirements for CLE credit. I didn't see that brief. Are you conceding it doesn't matter? Or how should it work into our analysis?
No, and I think it works right into the analysis, because you'll notice in reviewing the cases that the county cites in its brief, both for the common interest privilege and for the application of work product, the materials were never disseminated outside of the organization that created them. So you have the DC Circuit case from 2016, which is the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, where they were seeking a defense manual published by the Department of Justice for internal use only. The ACLU case from the Ninth Circuit in 2018, and then the O'Boyle case from New Jersey in 2014. None of those materials were shared with someone who has no interest in the outcome of any particular litigation, as these were. And it's not just the CLE board, of course. They were disseminated to the sponsor of the CLE, which is the Minnesota County Attorneys Association, which of course has no interest in the outcome of any particular litigation that may have been discussed in those materials. So it's absolutely relevant.
Right, but I'm just trying to get a sense of whether specifically the board, I haven't seen any cases of either attorney-client privilege or this common interest exception as applies to work product ever discussed in the idea of a CLE generally, but I was just thinking in the context of a CLE that has to include some oversight outside of the lawyers. And I didn't see that briefed. I'm wondering whether you think it's relevant and should be briefed for our consideration.
I don't think that needs any further briefing. I think the closest I can put you, Judge Ross, to something on point is the DC Circuit's 2016 decision, which juxtaposed work product protection with CLE materials. And there's actually a reference in that case in a few spots to the court saying, look, work product is generally generated by a lawyer in private to assess the client's case, whereas CLE materials are not. And that's as close as we found to any authority which talks about the fact that a CLE presentation is not work product.
So you didn't find any cases dealing with material submitted or any discussion of the fact that the materials have to be submitted, vetted, or subject to review, even if it wasn't actually reviewed by, subject to review by some other entity?
I did not, Your Honor, but the concept of CLE credit, as we pointed out in our brief and as one of the amicus did as well, the whole concept of CLE credit is public. The participants in a CLE do not have a vested interest in the outcome of any particular litigation, like parties to a joint defense agreement would have in the traditional case where parties are seeking to preserve the attorney-client privilege. A CLE is completely different. And I will note, Your Honor, that the record here indicates that numerous dozens, in fact, county attorneys reviewed this CLE. And there was no showing and certainly no finding that those county attorneys had tax litigation pending before it or even anticipated tax litigation. The only common interest they had was in obtaining CLE credit, which is not what the work doctrine.
Mr. Bradford, wouldn't that burden of showing that be on your client? And so setting aside the CLE, if a group of county attorneys had met, and let's say they'd met at the County Attorney Association headquarters, and they all had Walmart, which apparently is contesting property taxes all over the state, I assume, I mean, many commercial businesses do, but they were discussing strategy. I mean, is that then okay? Is it taking away the CLE that's the problem?
Well, the CLE, Your Honor, is certainly part of it, but let me be clear. Our position is not that county attorneys can never meet to discuss pending or anticipated litigation, but at least you have to have a piece of pending litigation that both lawyers are involved in or that both lawyers anticipate litigation. That was the key in the O'Boyle case that the county cites in its response is, although they were separate pieces of litigation, you had two council members who were facing either pending or anticipated litigation that got together. We don't have that here. In fact, I appreciate Your Honor's comment about the burden of proof. We did show the ALJ that nearly half of the attendees of this CLE had never even appeared in tax court. So what is the common interest and what is the privilege that was actually shared? And I want to get back to this concept of what is work product, because it really does drive the analysis here. And in City Pages, the court said to be protected as work product, material must contain opinions, conclusions, and legal theories. Now, the definition doesn't stop there, though. It says it has to have been prepared in anticipation of litigation. And why that's important in the context of this case is Anoka County told the ALJ below, and this is at addendum page 57, that, quote, the whole purpose of the presentation was to assist other counties that face similar issues to Anoka County, end quote. And then the MCAA also wrote, this is in Exhibit G to their response to the complaint below, quote, because the MCAA training documents are not prepared in anticipation of litigation, MCAA is not claiming that the documents satisfy all the requirements to be considered work product. So really the question in this case is this, whether the work product doctrine immunizes otherwise public data from disclosure when that data were prepared in a CLE presentation in anticipation of another party's litigation. And that's totally diametrically opposed to why we have work product privilege in the first place. It's to allow the lawyer who is participating in litigation an aura of privacy so that he or she can develop ideas and arguments and properly vet the case and candidly evaluate the client's case and have discussions regarding it. Here, there's no dispute. This CLE was not prepared in anticipation of any Anoka County litigation. It was prepared for CLE credit. And that is an undisputed fact in this case. And it plainly distinguishes this case from the various cases cited in the county's response brief. Judge Ross, to get back to one of your questions, what the county really wants.
So, Mr. Bradford, before you leave that topic, in terms of looking at this as the CLE presentation as attorney work product and whether it was prepared in anticipation of litigation, there is some case law out there about recurring legal problems. And I'd like you to address that because you're certainly correct. We have no authority in Minnesota on that issue, but I think there is some guidance elsewhere. And yes. There's certainly an argument that where there is a recurring legal issue, that there could attorneys could maintain a work product environment doing all the things that you're describing. And let's just set aside dissemination and disclosure for a moment, and that could be a work product scenario.
Right. And the two cases, and I've referred to them previously, are the D.C. Circuit case from 2016. That's the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. And then the ACLU case from the Ninth Circuit in 2018. Those both dealt with manuals prepared by the Department of Justice. And the argument was, well, you didn't prepare those in anticipation of any specific litigation. You only prepared them in anticipation of potential future litigation. And what the court said in those cases is, look, when you're somebody like the Department of Justice that is facing recurring common lawsuits and criminal prosecutions, you don't have to show that they're prepared in anticipation of any particular litigation. But of course, those materials were prepared for in-house purposes to train in-house DOJ lawyers. It would be different, Your Honor, if Anoka County prepared training materials to train its own lawyers to participate in tax appeals. That would be the type of thing that's covered by those cases, because
counsel, when I listen to your argument, it seems to me that then you're shifting over to whether the disclosure waives the attorney work product, not whether these materials are covered by work product. And no. I won't pester any further. I just would like to hear your answer on that. Thanks.
Yeah, and I appreciate your comment, Judge, because I don't intend to shift. The point here is that what was prepared in that PowerPoint presentation, admittedly, was not prepared by Anoka County in anticipation of any of its own litigation. It was prepared for purposes of presenting a CLE to other county attorneys to help them with their litigation. It's completely different from the DOJ cases where you have lawyers within the same department preparing a manual to help other lawyers in the same department with future litigation. Anoka County has no interest in the value of a Walmart in Mille Lacs County. Whether the county Mille Lacs prevails in its litigation has no bearing on Anoka County, which is what distinguishes.
Well, let me pause you there for a moment. There may be no direct bearing, but you weren't suggesting, are you, that it would benefit Anoka County and others if those counties who are facing future litigation succeed and help establish precedent that would benefit Anoka County and all counties with a common interest in the outcome generally?
May I answer your question, Judge? I see a lot of time.
Yes, please answer.
So if that's the standard, though, if simply precedent were the standard, then anytime I stand up to give a presentation as a lawyer to the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association on how to argue an appeal or how to cross-examine an expert, I can claim that my materials are privileged simply because I have an interest in developing a body of precedent. I think that's taking the work product doctrine too far, and I have not seen a case that's stretched it that far.
Thank you. You will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal if you choose to.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent.
On behalf of the respondent, Anoka County, in the matter. What this case is about is that whether two municipal attorneys who shared their litigation work product with other municipal attorneys tasked with defending the same type of litigation involving the same type of claims against the same type of adversaries now have to hand over that litigation work product to the adversary in their ongoing and future litigation.
Can I pause you for a moment in the way you framed it? Something of some concern to me was the idea that you advocate that these were all municipal attorneys. I know from my own experience, and perhaps all the members of our panel have similar experience in dealing with public sector clients, that sometimes public sector attorneys leave their public sector roles and they become private attorneys and they're free agents. They can represent private entities. They can go and represent developers, other public entities or private entities, even against the county. In this case, as I understand it, there were two, I think your brief refers to them as retired county attorneys, but don't we really mean that they were, at the time, private attorneys, not affiliated with any county?
Let me respond to that, Your Honor. That's because you're absolutely right. There were two retired county attorneys on that webinar. But the point that we're making, and the important point that's relevant to this case, is that every single viewer and accessor of that webinar and those training materials had MCAA credentials, and that's how they were accessing it. So in a sense, the MCAA credentials served as a self-sorting mechanism to ensure that every single person who was accessing it had a shared or joint common interest. So for example, if those attorneys were no longer doing any type of work that was related to the MCAA or to their public sector representation, it would no longer have MCAA access. That's what
is that in the record, that a private attorney is no longer a member, no longer has access to the MCAA if that attorney is contemplating going to work for a private entity? Is there something in the procedure in this case that safeguarded against that possibility?
Yes, and before I answer, I do want to just set the backdrop for this answer, and that the legal analysis does not demand that those who are disseminating the information, it doesn't demand perfection out of them. What it demands is a reasonable expectation of confidentiality based on the circumstances presented. And so just setting that as the backdrop, what you have here, this is in the record, is that you have attorneys Stover and Carney reaching out to the MCAA, asking, we want to give this training seminar. We are expecting a big case to come up. We have litigated this type of litigation previously, and we've solicited interest from other public attorneys who are presented with the same problem. And so what that does is it sets the stage that there is ongoing litigation, they are anticipating future litigation, and they are specifically asking and going through a channel and venue that is limited to other attorneys who are handling and defending this type of litigation. That's what they do.
Mr. Yount, what about Mr. Bradford's example? What if this was a presentation to the ABA personal injury lawyers and county attorneys? Part of what they do is the civil legal work for the county, which could include slip and fall cases. So would you claim the same work product protection if you were giving a national presentation to the public injury section of the ABA?
And it depends on the facts. I don't want to be a lawyer in that response, but it is a factual determination that we're talking about here. And if they did take the appropriate steps to ensure that every single attorney or agent or representative who was attending that training session and seminar did have a shared and joint common interest, then yes, we would take the position that those training materials would still be entitled to work product immunity.
Again, there are county attorneys, I'm assuming, who are members of the MCAA who maybe don't have big box stores in them that are contesting or likely to contest property taxes. I mean, it wasn't that level of checking, was it?
No, Your Honor. What we did is we took methodical steps to make sure that basically the only people who could access these training materials were those that we could reasonably foresee as still being MCAA members and being public attorneys representing or representatives of county attorney offices across the state. That was the vetting mechanism, and we take the position that that was appropriate here.
Because there were non-lawyers also, am I correct, in the group of individuals who had access to the materials?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's actually a helpful fact because it shows the steps that we took to ensure that it was limited strictly to those who had common interests. So first of all, the outside case law cited in the briefs, such as the De Alessandro case and the Deloitte case, they established that it doesn't need to be limited to attorneys in order to be a shared common interest. So that is not a mandatory or necessary requirement in order to preserve the work product doctrine. It can be external agents that are not lawyers, but that they still share a common interest.
Can you address the question that neither addressed in the brief, which is, it just kind of floated into my head, and you're free to say it's irrelevant, but I am concerned if we were to rule in your favor that we're essentially saying that material that is disclosed to in part and subject to exposure based upon the oversight responsibilities of a continuing legal education board it's not the kind of disclosure that we should be concerned about when it comes to waiving the work product privilege.
Yeah, and that's a good question, Your Honor. And I want to kind of lead that back to your initial question to Mr. Bradford about what is the importance of the CLE accreditation. And the respondent's position is that that is an ancillary issue that does not really impact this based on the timeline in the record and based on the law. And if I might, just let me explain that. So if you look at the time frame, what happened was the attorneys Stover and Carney reached out to MCAA about training materials and obtaining CLE credit. What they did subsequent to those emails is they sent a brief description of what the CLE would be. It's a one paragraph sentence overarching explanation of what it would be. The MCAA then in turn forwarded that paragraph to the CLE board, and they received one accreditation for CLE credit. That's important here because what that shows is that the PowerPoint and the specific underlying training materials were never disseminated to the CLE board. They never requested.
But here's my question. This goes to my question, and I gather from the record that that was never presented to the CLE board. But if I read the CLE board rules correctly, the CLE board has the oversight authority to authorize CLE credit only for certain types of things, including issues that bear upon the subject matter of those things, and even the presentation, the audio quality, the procedures, the questions and answers. It seems pretty clear to me that the CLE board, whether they in fact explored further the presentation or received the actual materials, that they had the authority to review those materials, and that by submitting for approval the materials and going ahead with the CLE, that the presenters of the CLE were leaving open the possibility that someone other than those in their organization would in fact review all of the substance. Am I correct about my presumption about how this could work?
Yes, and let me respond this way. You are correct that the CLE board has oversight, and if there was an issue that came up, they could subsequently review and request the materials if they needed to. That is not inconsistent with the common interest doctrine, and here's why. The common interest doctrine prohibits disclosures to adversaries or disclosures in a way that is reasonably calculated that would lead to an adversary obtaining that document or the underlying work product. What could be done if the CLE board really needed those materials is they could review it themselves. There could be a settlement agreement. There could be a limited disclosure agreement. The CLE board would not have any, you know, for instance, ability to transfer it over to the adversaries if they felt necessary. That is not inconsistent with what the common interest doctrine recommends or recognizes.
Well, there has to be some presumed safeguarding of the material, and that's, I guess, goes to another question. One, we don't know whether members of the CLE board were on one side or the other on this issue, or are prevented from sharing information if they had access to it. But even a greater concern, a different concern, is once you present material through a webinar, I guess you call it these days, and you're broadcasting, it's true that you can control who it is who is officially on the call or on the webcast, but don't you have to also take steps in order to rely upon this common interest doctrine? Don't you also have to take steps to communicate to individuals who are watching it that only those who are signed up are viewing the material or present in the room? I mean, there's control if you were at a live CLE to who comes in the door. But I mean, you don't know. I could have seven people standing over here off to my side watching this presentation and making gestures about you guys. They aren't, by the way, and I wouldn't allow it, but nothing would prevent it. And I'm wondering whether that matters in the common interest exception.
Yeah, it does, Your Honor. And that's actually a really good point that I intended to raise, is that compare this to a physical training session that it sounds like Mr. Bradford does not oppose would actually still retain work product doctrine, is that if you had county attorneys gathering in a physical room to discuss legal strategies about this type of litigation, it appears that Mr. Bradford conceded that that would still be entitled to work product doctrine. Now, what we have here is we don't have a perfect analog to that, but what we have here are reasonable steps taken to ensure that it still retains confidentiality in the dissemination of those materials. And just to put a finer point on what is exactly before the court, this court is presented with an issue of first impression about whether the common interest doctrine applies in Minnesota. The standard relied upon by the ALJ below and the standard that should be adopted if this court goes with it, I do just want to draw the court's attention to it, is we're advocating for the D. Alessandro enunciation because that accords with Eighth Circuit precedent, the Third Restatement, and the Minnesota Practice Series enunciation of the waiver and the common interest doctrine. And that standard, as stated, is that disclosure of work product to a third party does not result in a waiver if there is a reasonable expectation of confidentiality between the transferor and transferee. Now, applied to the facts of this case, is there a reasonable expectation of confidentiality? We say there was, and the ALJ held that there was, because again, what you have is you have an MCAA credentialed member, regardless of whether there's anyone else in the room, but they are representing that they are the people that are accessing and viewing the webinar. And they know that the only way that you can access and view the webinar is through MCAA credentials. It's not a perfect system. We don't call every single viewer to ensure that they are ongoing litigation, that they are still working. That would be untenable. We can't do that. What we did instead is, again,
well, you could do that.
We could, Your Honor. That is physically possible. But the law doesn't demand that. What the law demands is whether there's a reasonable expectation of confidentiality between the transferor and the transferee. And I do, if I just want to point out another helpful way to think about this that's borne out by the case law, is that the common interest doctrine has two sides to it. There's an affirmative side and a negative side. And what I mean by that is that on the affirmative side, you look to see whether the joint parties share a common interest affirmatively in the either ongoing litigation or anticipation of litigation. And that's what the record shows here, and that's what we've been talking about. But on the other side of that coin, in the negative, is you have to look to see, are you disseminating it in a way that will lead or reasonably lead to an adversary? That's the flip side of the coin. And that absolutely is not shown anywhere in the record here. Think about it in a more abstract sense. There's no possible case out there where there is a county attorney or a county on the other side of a tax appeal with Anoka County. We are never, by definition, going to be adversaries. We are all statutorily bound to defend property tax assessment.
Mr. Young, can I just interrupt for a minute here? I'm not entirely clear on exactly what remains from what has already been provided to Walmart by Anoka County. Is it the WebEx and the PowerPoint? Is that the sum total of what's at stake here? Or are there other documents as well?
No,
and being withheld.
Perhaps how you feel about it, that could be a great irony or the great truth of this case, is the only thing that's been withheld from Walmart from Anoka County itself is the PowerPoint that was presented as a sealed exhibit below. Respondent Anoka County does not obtain we never retained the WebEx because we were not the host of it. The MCAA held that information. But perhaps to your honor's point about why are we here about this, that's relevant to the question of the work product doctrine itself, because again, just lightly touching on the history here, we know why Relator wants this, because they represented to multiple adjudicative bodies that this is relevant to their ongoing litigation, and they think this will help their litigation and help them win in their cases. They want the Anoka County's, I guess you call it the secret sauce for why we keep winning. That's not strictly relevant for submitting a data practices request, but it is highly relevant for the work product question. I see that my time is up, and so unless there's any other questions, respondent Anoka County requests that this court affirm the ALJ on all grounds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for Relator, any rebuttal? You are speaking silently with your mute button still on.
Thank you, Rod. I'm not used to having to do that.
Yes.
Three quick points. And Judge Siegel, I want to return to the question that you asked my friend on the other side, which is what is really at issue here. We do have the emails, which of course was one of our three requests. We do not have the actual PowerPoint presentation, which remains at issue, as well as the webinar, which exists to this day on the MCAA websites and is accessible by everyone who the county claims participated in the CLE, including its three lawyers. The county responded to the Data Practices Act request by saying it had material responsive to all three requests. And I'll note on page 6 of the ALJ's findings, he actually made findings with respect to the content of the webinar. So clearly the ALJ had access to it, because he said that in the last paragraph that Mr. Stover and Mr. Carney broadcast their privileged assessments through a webinar. So both mediums are still at issue. Number two is...
You're not saying the county's withholding. You have no evidence of knowing that the county's not telling the truth, that they do not have the webinar.
I guess I don't know that they're not telling the truth. They clearly have access to it. All they have to do is click on the link for the CLE that they prepared. But I'm not accusing anyone of misrepresenting a fact. Number two, though, is most of the comments that were made in the presentation by respondent had to do with the common interest privilege. And again, the common interest doctrine is not a standalone privilege. And this would not be the case to adopt the common interest doctrine in Minnesota, because you can't just skip over what the asserted privilege is. And in this case, it's the work product doctrine. And you did not hear one word from the other side about how this particular document was prepared in anticipation of any litigation, which is what the work product doctrine requires. So even if you get past that, though, you still have to address the scope of common interest. And my friend said, well, this was simply a mechanism to share strategies with other lawyers, other attorneys who were, quote, handling similar litigation. And that's just inaccurate. In the undisputed facts, number 50 and 51, 50 is three individuals are not even working for an attorney county attorney's office. 51 is nearly half of them have never appeared in tax court. The notion that these attorneys are participating in similar litigation or even are anticipating similar litigation is unsupported in the record. Thank you for your time today, Your Honor.
Mr. Bradford, I want to follow up for a moment. Your question about, or your comment about the attendees who have not appeared in tax court. Yeah. I think, I don't know if it's Minnesota law, but I think that Mr. Yount is correct that the attorney work product privilege has never been restricted to attorneys, dissemination to attorneys. That, for instance, the legal assistance in your office can be covered by a work product privilege, or your preparation of work product can be shared with your legal assistants. Am I right about that? Because I think that undercuts your argument, but maybe I'm missing something.
No, you're right in that lawyers and agents within their own corporation can share documents without waiving a privilege. What I'm saying, though, Judge, is this isn't work product to begin with, because it's not prepared in anticipation of any litigation. We'd have a very different case if.
But my point, Mr. Bradford, is that whether someone has appeared or not appeared in tax court really isn't relevant to our analysis on work product. It's the other part of what you're saying. You're insisting that it should be prepared in anticipation of litigation, and that that litigation must be actual, not just a recurring legal problem.
Correct. Whether it's shared outside of the agency who created it is relevant to whether it's common interest, whether there's a waiver, and whether the common interest exception saves that waiver. And my point in saying that the other lawyers aren't involved in tax litigation goes to whether, if you adopt a common interest privilege, whether it would apply here. Because in all of the other cases that have been cited to the court, there are things like joint defense agreements, lawyers who are interested in the same case or have at least similar pending cases or anticipated cases against them. And my point simply is that these lawyers that chimed in for the CLE, the only evidence in the record is that they were interested in getting CLE credit, not for purposes of prosecuting or defending any tax litigation. And without that showing, how can there be a common interest privilege? What is the common interest? You cannot have a common interest in simply hypothetical future litigation that may never occur, which is very different than the recurring cases that we talked about earlier.
Well, thank you. Thank you to both counsel for your time, for your written material, and for your oral arguments today. We very much appreciate it. Nicely done. Both of your clients should be very satisfied with the work that you put into this case. So we appreciate it. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory period.